Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I'm joined by Bo. I'm Josh. So we are going to be talking about consciousness and specifically human consciousness. And consciousness, in my opinion, is one of the most interesting areas of psychology, something that we've all got direct experience of, and yet it remains one of psychology's greatest mysteries. The human brain, as far as I'm concerned, is the most complicated thing in the known universe. And consciousness is probably the most difficult to understand aspect of that thing. And therefore, we even have problems defining what it is. So we're not exactly endeavouring on something easy here. You're not going to necessarily have satisfying answers, but there's lots of really, really interesting questions and interesting stuff here. And the picture that we're building of human consciousness is fascinating to me. And I am very excited to actually talk about it as well.
I know this is right in your wheelhouse. I mean,
it is indeed, yeah.
That is really your stuff mm-hmm. that you know most about. So I'm really looking forward to it, looking forward to learning a few things.
I did my undergraduate dissertation looking at unconscious decision making. And obviously, to define what the unconscious is, you need to define consciousness to some degree, to some working level. And therefore, I've actually carried out some research, although it didn't amount to very much because the findings were inconclusive. But nevertheless, I did lots of work understanding these sorts of things, and I'm looking forward to talking about it. So on the question of actually defining consciousness, it's incredibly difficult to get any definition from the scientific community because there is no consensus. And you can ask various psychologists, neurologists, and neuroscientists for their own working definition, and they'll all vary. One of the ones that I see banded about quite often is you could define consciousness as the experience of being human, which, you know, seems relatively intuitive. That seems fair enough, doesn't it? But it's so broad that it's not really a useful definition, despite it being correct.
I was going to say that's too specific.
Really?
Well, just in the sense that I would consider, say, let's say a dog mm-hmm. conscious. You talked earlier just before mm-hmm. we started recording about a hierarchy of consciousness, there's different
yes.
sort of grades of consciousness, if you mm-hmm. like. But so on that spectrum, mm-hmm. Just take for an example, because we had a similar-ish conversation before for a previous contemplations, that a dog has a type of consciousness, mm-hmm. you know, like it dreams, and it obviously has feelings, you know, mm-hmm. it clearly has regret, and they can be frightened and enraged mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. And even obviously has a memory, and it can take mm-hmm. commands like a sheepdog anyway. So it's obviously a lower grade of consciousness. Mm-hmm. It can't really problem solve, although maybe a small amount. But so like maybe a chimp or a bonobo is higher than a dog.
Yes.
And a human's higher than a chimp. Mm-hmm. But would you not say that a dog is conscious?
So the distinction in this psychological literature is that human beings are uniquely conscious. There are aspects okay. of our mental life that are unique to human beings and make us exceptional when compared to other animals. So you can still use the language of consciousness to compare other animals, but right. to purely describe an animal as being conscious, it has to be a
okay.
human being.
Okay, fair
but
enough.
You can still say, okay, here's a rank order of hierarchies of consciousness. And you can say like an octopus is more conscious than, I don't know, a locust or something.
I also feel like if you're going to sort of do it that way, define mm-hmm. things that way, I sort of feel like I'm more conscious now than when I was a child then, if we're going to talk about mm-hmm. it in these terms.
Yeah, well,
I'm sort of more conscious now.
That's certainly something we're going to get to, that okay. your consciousness isn't static. It changes all the time.
Right, right.
And the nature of the consciousness changes between individuals. And that sounds somewhat counterintuitive because, of course, I said, well, all humans are conscious, obviously, when they're awake. And to add that caveat, you know, when the human brain is normally functioning, it is conscious. When there's not any medical problems with it or you're asleep. But the nature of that consciousness, because of the components that make it up, is shaped by your genetics, your experience, all of these various factors that shape all other aspects of human psychology. And we'll take a look at what actually makes up consciousness once we're done trying to define what it is, so I actually can pin down what we're talking about. So returning to the definition of the experience of being human, of course, you could argue that there are plenty of human experiences that aren't entirely conscious either. I can experience my heart beating despite not consciously controlling it. However, I am consciously directing my attention to the sensation, which leads you to have to answer the question, well, where do you draw the line between conscious and unconscious? Because, of course, there is a line to be drawn there. It seems like, anyway, it's difficult to say. But things that you're aware of, things that you're not. And of course, awareness seems to feature a lot in these sorts of definitions.
It's funny, like, say, for example, breathing. I feel like I'm consciously breathing. But if I were to fall asleep, my body would still do it for me. Mm-hmm. Or even if someone knocked me out, as long as it didn't kill me, I'd still be breathing.
I'm manually breathing now, so thanks a lot.
Sorry. You know what I mean? Or there's the old thing when someone talk about blinking, you can't help but keep blinking more until you forget about it again.
I think you have the ability to consciously override an automatic process, but there are some that are so important that you're not allowed to do it. I imagine that if someone was able to consciously override their heart beating, they'd die out pretty quickly, and therefore they wouldn't be able to pass on their genes. And
I think some people can affect it. That Wim Hof guy, I think he
the Iceman.
Just through will or just practice or something, I don't know. I don't know his skills. But he can, and certain people can lower their heart rate, can't they? Just with...
Surely it would be things like breathing exercises. And
I suppose so.
You can also use your mind to sort of get yourself into a more... sedate sort of contemplative state, which also lowers your heart rates. There are lots of things you can deliberately do to lower it and influence it, but you're not in direct control. You have to influence it indirectly through other means, as far as I understand it anyway. I might be wrong about that.
It must be, again, a spectrum thing, so you can't sort of, no matter how good you are, no matter how sort of like a Wim Hof level of mastery of your own body, you can't sort of consciously make your fingernails grow faster, say, can you? You can't do that.
No.
But still, it does seem that there's sort of quite a lot. Do you think that the brain or consciousness plays a big part in all sorts of physical effects? For example, if you just suffer under stress for years on end, you're more likely to get other diseases. That seems to be the case, doesn't it? Does research show that, just for example?
That's I'm sorry, this is a bit of a tangent. Yes. That's definitely true, that if you experience stress, that basically stress is intended... I say intended as if it's been designed, but the stress mechanism is typically only for short bursts. It's for the fight or flight response. So if you have prolonged stress, it actually weakens your immune system.
Okay, and that makes perfect sense, right?
It's to do with the stress chemicals, your adrenalines, your noradrenalines, your norepinephrines, that sort of thing. Those aren't good for your body in long exposure scenarios, because it does things like doesn't make your food digest properly and things like that, because in the temporary situation it helps you either run away or fight, so it's preparing your body physically. It makes you more resistant to pain and stuff like that, but in the long term it degrades your body, it wears you down. It's a bit like testosterone in a way, in that it gives you short-term physical enhancements, but long term it degrades your body over time, which is why men die before women, because we have more testosterone and it's not good for the preservation of your body, more or less.
Do you know what's just popped into my mind? When you're under sort of the fight or flight type situation, or it might not even be that, it might be something like you're in a boxing match, or if you're in a race car and time slows down, and it really does, like it really, well, it feels like it does, of course it doesn't really, but it really, really feels like it, that you've got, your reaction times are way, way quicker when you're, brain is flooded with whatever chemicals. I mean, could you say that your consciousness has been heightened in that state?
I think it would be your attention that's an aspect of consciousness, but consciousness is a much broader church of things, really. Right. And we'll talk about the different components about it, but I think that when you're talking about consciousness, The language you need to use has to focus on the specific component that makes up consciousness, I think, to be accurate. Because sometimes if you talk about consciousness just more broadly, it obfuscates the nature of the phenomenon you're trying to get at. And in that case, I think it would be your attentional capacity, because you're focusing on that thing, and therefore, with your attention directed to it, you're more focused on doing that thing efficiently, correctly, and therefore you're less aware of the passage of time, because you're dealing with a large amount of sensory information that you're having to navigate with your attentional capacity and through directing, imagine if with the racing go-karting example, that would be mostly visual information. There wouldn't be much auditory or sort of skin conductance and that sort of stuff. It's not going to be that so much. It's more going to be prioritizing what visual information is important. And of course, you learn to do that over time. So you'd learn, okay, well, I'm moving a bit sideways. Maybe I need to level out. Otherwise, I'm going to skid out and do a U-turn or something. And that sort of thing. But turning back to defining consciousness, that's all right. Another commonly cited definition is that consciousness is the psychological processes in which we are aware of, which is one that I alluded to just a second ago. However, this is also unsatisfactory because awareness of something can exist without being conscious of it. So I think a good way of characterizing it would be a mind can be consciously aware, but it cannot be aware without also being conscious. In this case, consciousness can exist on its own, but awareness cannot exist without consciousness.
Right. What's an example of that? What do you mean?
So I've got lots of examples of it. So you've got a clinical condition known as anosognosia, which is a symptom of severe mental illness experienced by some people that impairs a person's ability to understand and perceive their illness. So experiments have demonstrated that some patients who have the inability to raise their hand come up with post hoc rationalizations for this inability. So they'll say, oh, I didn't want to, or something like that, even though they don't have the physical ability. I've just realized as well that the characterization there that I've given about consciousness and it cannot exist without awareness cannot exist without consciousness, that somewhat contradicts what I said about awareness being something that exists outside of consciousness, which is very confusing. And I just wanted to clarify that even defining what awareness is very difficult. Like in that scenario, to me, that seems like they don't have an awareness of their inability, even though that they're conscious that they're not moving their hand. Like it's a difficult thing to try and pin down the nature of the two. So depending on the circumstance, I think is a better way of putting it, you can have awareness without consciousness or vice versa.
With this apply, you know, the Dunning-Kruger effect, where you're mm-hmm. so ignorant, you don't know how ignorant you are.
Mm-hmm.
And you can throw on top of that, that people do tell you how ignorant you are and sort of prove it. And you refuse to accept that. And people do, don't they? I mean, that sort of plays out a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's very different to the example you said with being physically able to raise your hand or not.
Mm-hmm.
But would that be part of it? Would that play into it? Or would you say it's a completely separate
phenomenon?
I think
that's more to do with denial of...
Okay.
It's a sort of egoism going on there, isn't there? Where it's not necessarily an inability, but an unwillingness. It's more of... Yeah. It's more controlled by emotional states than it is by a cognitive capacity. But there are other things as well, like Anton syndrome, which is a form of visual anosognosia, which is a denial of vision loss. So this is associated with making up experiences to compensate for memory loss when they have cortical blindness. So their eyes work, but it's their brain, the visual cortices that have been damaged. This is often done by caused by a stroke and affects things like the occipital lobe. And they basically deny that they're blind, even though they don't have the ability to see.
Oh.
And it's not that they're deliberately trying to mislead people. It's that they don't believe they're blind. They're
That's interesting.
Almost like unaware. It's
That's
a very
really
rare. There are only about 28 cases known to medicine.
Okay.
But it seems to be a pretty robust thing. It's obviously very rare because it's a very specific kind of disorder, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I've never heard of that. That is interesting. And 28, although that's hardly any, that's still plenty though, right?
Enough to clarify.
Right, yeah.
Like there's no cultural specificity to it or age specificity. It's just people who have had that form of brain injury that causes that sort of thing. So... You can also look at examples from normal functioning as well, where you can hear a real world noise in your dreams and you can incorporate it into your dream, like an alarm might be going off or the phone might be ringing. You dream that you pick up the phone or something like that, or you turn off the alarm, but yet you're still hearing it. Yeah. And that's clear that you have some sort of awareness, but you don't have consciousness because you're asleep.
All right, yeah.
So this is this weird sort of juxtaposition that I was trying to get at earlier. Some psychologists deny that, you know, they're saying that you still have awareness and some degree of consciousness, but if you define being asleep as being conscious, then that opens up a much larger can of worms and saying, okay, well, you have some sort of awareness, but you don't have consciousness.
Mm.
So I feel like that's a better explanation. And also, there are examples of our consciousness being heightened rather than being impaired as well, in just showing how much it can change. So the neurologist Oliver Sacks, he's quite well known for his book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, which I quite enjoyed, by the way.
I've read that. I thought that was excellent. Mm-hmm. It's quite short as well, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It's worth a read, that, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. But he reported having an extremely heightened sense of smell after a night under the influence of amphetamines, cocaine and PCP as a medical student.
Oh, right.
So apparently for quite some time, he had a really, really good sense of smell after taking these chemicals, which is weird. You think all these things going up your nose... not going to do you any good, but apparently so. And there are other cases. You don't necessarily have to take his word for it, of people having heightened senses. Of course, there's the very common colloquial one where a blind person has better sense of smell and hearing than a normal person. So we understand that the senses are malleable in how much awareness we have, how much sensory information we can make use of, I think is a better way of putting it than using awareness.
Have you ever been, well, I know you have, you know, like you're out camping or you're out in the wilderness in some way and it's completely pitch black and you or the party of people you're with have deliberately decided not to use torches or anything to get your night vision, and that's a very real thing. But your hearing does seem to be a bit sharper, or maybe it's just me, maybe it's psychosomatic, but it feels like it really is.
My working theory of it is that it's more attentional. It's that you focus more on your auditory inputs in the absence of visual inputs. Right. But that's only, you know, I'm not as familiar with the literature as I could be, because you need a ridiculously intimate knowledge of all of psychology to answer some of these questions.
But that does make perfect sense. Why would your eardrums suddenly function better? They wouldn't, would they? It's just that you're paying closer attention to it, I suppose. Have you ever seen the example of I saw before someone that was blind, I think they were blind from birth, and they could make click sounds, and just like sonar, like a bat, they could sort of they sort of knew where obstacles were in their way by making these clicking sounds as they moved around.
I've heard about that before, yeah.
And so perhaps their hearing really is much more heightened than an average person.
You'd imagine
it just is.
If they didn't have sight, they'd probably take better care of their ears as well. Well, so they'd focus on their hearing more, so they'd stay away from loud noises. And it's amazing how often we come into contact with noises that actually damage our hearing over time, in just in normal function. So it could be that someone who is deprived of one sense makes more effort to focus on others, and also focuses on honing their ability with those senses, or using the information that's provided. Because one thing that we quite often forget about our senses is that we get bombarded with lots and lots of information that we don't necessarily pay attention to. And we have this noisy data, and our attention navigates the important parts of it. And I think you can refine the attentional process through experience. So a really good rally driver will be able to tell, almost sense, whether they're going to slide on the track before it happens. And it's this experience and this knowledge that no matter how conscious or deliberate, you can't really recreate it without the knowledge of how things interact in the first place.
Do you think, just very quickly on that, do you think that the difference between people that had sight and then went blind for whatever reason might be different to people that were born profoundly blind or born without eyes?
Well, I heard quite a funny anecdote recently of people who were born blind and gain their sight again. Oh no, it's born... sorry, is born deaf and regain their hearing, sorry, think that the sun makes a noise.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I've never heard that before. That's really interesting.
But I suppose it makes sense because it's silenced by the vacuum of space, but you'd think that this big ball of fire in the sky would make a really loud noise, but when they regain their hearing, they're like, oh, that's strange. The sun's just up there. It's not making any noise. That's weird. So it's interesting to me what you think, what you take for granted with sensory inputs and what you might not. It's a weird thing, but it certainly seems to change your perception of reality once you have that.
You know, like when there's maybe an extraction fan in your mm-hmm. bathroom and you've just zoned out that dull whining mm-hmm. sound and then it shuts itself off and you suddenly realise, oh, that's much quieter. Yeah, that's, I guess I'd...
That's, again, your attentional capacity. So constant right. noises can be cancelled out. It's variations that really aggravate you over time. That's why crying baby is so unpleasant, because not only is it the correct frequency to elicit like an alarmed state and a sense of being unsettled, but also the cry oscillates in its pitch, which is that's why we alarms are, you know, stopping and starting noises. It's not just a constant beep, because then it's easier to cancel it out. It's stop, start, because the space emphasizes it and the changes in pitch, say. So that's a means of it directing our attention. Another thing that can sort of change our state of consciousness are psychedelics. And when you look at people who've used them under neuroimaging equipment, the brain basically lights up like a Christmas tree. It's quite stark, and it's a very broad network of brain areas as well. It's not just, okay, it's that area there. You see the whole brain start to light up, whereas ordinarily, in usual use, you have specific brain areas light up for specific functions. And it's hypothesized that because all of the brain areas activate at once, that's why you have this sort of synesthesia of feeling like you can taste colors and all that sort of stuff, where your senses kind of blend together and you lose the sense of yourself because you don't normally have all of these areas functioning at the same time. But the experience of it can also change the nature of a person's consciousness. Recent research has shown that a dose of psilocybin allows people with terminal cancer to better come to terms with their death and things like that, which is quite a serious recognition, isn't it? It's not exactly inconsequential in their mind.
So would it be like actually changing your brain chemistry?
Well,
would it be fair to say that? Or at least
there's some debate about how it actually works. So it could be that it forms new connections with pre-existing neurons. It's also neurogenic in that it encourages the creation of new neurons. Or it could, in theory, just connect areas that otherwise wouldn't be connected because of this activation of all the brain areas at once. And it's sort of, I've heard people describe it as like a factory reset of your brain. You're kind of booting and rebooting it again, and therefore you can kind of break out of the habits. And this is why it's very good for quitting smoking. Lots of people have said after they've taken psychedelics, they never have another cigarette again.
Really?
It's very effective, actually, from the data that we have now.
That's interesting.
It is quite fascinating, isn't it, that you can... And I think the mycologist Paul Stamets had this experience of just one day, he just quit smoking immediately after a psychedelic experience, even though he'd done it before many times.
I guess I remember watching a clip, I think it's kind of famous-ish, of Sir Christopher Mayhew. Oh, no, wait. That's not his name. That's a famous diplomat. I don't need to besmirch the name of Sir Christopher Mayhew. It was somebody else, Mayhew. And it's from the 60s, I believe, maybe even the 50s. And it was because LSD is man-made, isn't it? Synthesized, doesn't exist.
Well, it occurs naturally in a fungus known as ergo or ergot, which happens on wheat. And it's actually one of the reasons that people think the Salem witch trials happened was because they had they reported having this fungus on their food, and because it was their only food supply, they made bread with this fungus, which would have contained LSD. So they would have really thought that, wow, someone's cast a spell on me. What's going on?
I mean, sort of like highly concentrated liquid LSD.
Yes,
like
not to the same liquid. Not to the same degree as that.
And when they first synthesized that, it wasn't illegal for a while. It took the authorities a few years to realize it was sort of could be quite dangerous in some ways, or for whatever reason they decided to make. And you mentioned psilocybin, and then there's like a mescaline as well.
Right? There's quite a few, yeah.
And anyway, this I think his name was Mayhew. Anyway, he's taken. Well, I think to modern standards was loads. I think it might have been psilocybin. I'm not sure. And he's and as for an experiment, you know, he's like a very straight laced, serious person. And this like this new drug, and he's trying. And he's sitting in a chair. It's all filmed. I think I'm sure you can find the footage on YouTube. And he's sort of perfectly lucid. Really, he's not slurring his words. His eyes seem clear enough. He's calm, perfectly calm as can be. But he's saying things like. I'm currently moving through dimensions. Thousands of years are passing by to what you seems like a blink of an eye. Saying all things like this. So his brain, there's no way to, I guess, argue that his brain chemistry hasn't at least temporarily been sort of quite profoundly changed.
Well, the reason that it acts as it does is because the molecule, the lysergic acid diethylamide molecule binds to the serotonin receptor almost better than serotonin itself. And the serotonin receptor is like a mood-altering thing. So it makes you feel very euphoric, but it also has lots of other associated effects as well. And therefore, it's purely neurochemical. So it's definitely changing what's going on in your brain, which then alters the state of your consciousness because the neurons that pass on these signals are sending different signals because of this neurochemical binding to their receptors. And then encouraging is it's an excitatory molecule, so it sends the neurons to send more signals to other areas of the brain, which is also why it lights up in neuroimaging.
Would you say that their consciousness has been changed either temporarily or forever? Because it's like once that drug has worn off, you can still remember though what it felt like, can't you?
It's certainly changed temporarily, but I would argue that your consciousness is never constant in the first place, and your experiences shape your consciousness anyway. Okay. So to say that it has changed their consciousness is not as profound as it seems.
Of course it has. Right.
Yeah, this conversation is going to change your consciousness because all of your experiences do, because it's a means of understanding sensory inputs. So the sensory inputs, of course, change the nature of how your brain functions in the future. That's why we can understand cause and effect in the first place. So what we can take from the examples we've gone through so far is that consciousness is certainly not static. I think that's fair to say. It changes all the time, and this depends on physical states in the brain. It can be either heightened or depreciated. Some people do. Many psychologists, many other people, particularly physicists seem to have a less material understanding of what consciousness is, in that it's difficult to pin down at a physical level sometimes. Although I personally believe that it's all based in your head. It's all about the physical structures in your brain, the neurochemistry, the neural networks and how they're structured, and the roles of the different parts of the brain, your life experiences, these sorts of things that have a physical effect on your brain. I feel like that's how you get consciousness. And there are lots of questions that are raised about this that I am going to get onto. But I briefly wanted to quickly cover history of consciousness research, not a very thorough history, just to emphasize the fact that it's been a problem for as long as we can remember, and pointing at some of the key points where we gained a key insight about the nature of consciousness, just to bring people up to speed about where things are today. So I think one of the earliest examples is, of course, Buddhism, where they conceptualized consciousness as a state of mind in which you have awareness of your own thoughts, which I think is still a relatively cohesive understanding of what consciousness is. I mean, it's certainly an aspect of it, even if it's not a totalizing thing.
That's funny, isn't it? Do you ever have a thought that you didn't consciously sum up? As far as you're concerned, it just popped in there.
Well,
and then you're shocked by it or surprised by it.
No thoughts conscious. All thoughts are derived from your unconscious mind, because you don't think, I'm going to think about this thing, and then you think about it. It's not as cause and effect as that. They just kind of appear, don't they? When I'm walking along the street, I don't think, oh, that's that's a very fat pigeon. It just kind of pops up into my head. Right. I don't say, I'm going to examine the size of the pigeon and I have established that the pigeon is very large.
Right.
It's more just, oh, that's weird. Right. Like it's just something that suddenly appears because I feel like your unconscious mind is where a lot of the work gets done, if you will. There's a lot of the information processing going on. And I feel like it's almost like the unconscious mind is a horse and the conscious mind is a jockey. You can sometimes control what the horse is doing, right. But the horse is still its own entity. And ultimately, in the end, the horse is the one in control.
Right. I like that. That's an interesting way of thinking about it. Although, I mean, are there not exceptions to that? So, for example, I'll think to myself, consciously think to myself, I'm going to try and picture, I'll picture in my mind's eye, mm-hmm. I don't know, a very specific type of car, a GT40 or something. And then mm-hmm. I'll make another, like it might be a split second later, but still it's later. Then consciously recall the image of, say, a GT40.
Mm-hmm.
So
you can, you don't have a complete loss of control,
right.
But if there's a conflict between the unconscious and the conscious, or the conscious mind conjures something up to be brought to your conscious awareness, then you can't just be like, no, not receiving any conscious stuff today. It just appears. It's like the phenomena of don't think of a white elephant, and then you immediately yeah. think of a white elephant. Right. Like,
yeah.
No matter how hard you try, the image just appears, doesn't it?
Hmm.
And so it is one of those things where you might feel like you have perfect conscious control, but you don't really. Hmm. And lots of the research that I'm going to be going through today is actually going to show that our understanding of consciousness in a colloquial sense isn't, we perceive it as being far greater and significant in the processes of the human mind than it really is. And actually, it's not as important as many of the unconscious processes that seem to take precedence because they are more automatic. So returning to some of the history, lots of philosophers have obviously had lots to say about consciousness, all the way from Aristotle to people like Bertrand Russell. But I really don't have enough time to talk about them. And also, I don't think that they have as much to contribute as modern psychology does, in that they were working with just, you know, sitting in an armchair, thinking about stuff, rather than, you know, doing experiments and doing empirical research into what's going on. They didn't have neuroimaging equipment. So I'm not faulting them, but I also think that they're a product of their time's understanding. So Wilhelm Wundt, was the first man to describe himself as a psychologist and also the first to set up an experimental psychology lab. And he believed that consciousness could be investigated by reducing it to its components, as well as through merely introspecting. And I think that that's a key point in our understanding of consciousness, because reducing it to its components is kind of what we do today to understand it. The different parts, things like memory, attention, sort of sensory information, that sort of thing. We have separate fields where we have specialists looking at these things and how they integrate with the wider brain area. We don't necessarily have consciousness researchers. They're quite rare because you need people sort of on the ground, if you will, looking at the actual processes themselves and how they work, rather than trying to stitch it all together and say, okay, here it is, here's how the brain works all in one. You're kind of trying to run before you can walk.
Right.
But I'll get onto that a bit more in a second. So Freud was, of course, interested in consciousness and also coined the term unconscious, and obviously was the first to describe things passing between the conscious and unconscious mind. So that's another key benchmark. I know I'm very critical of psychoanalysis and the Freudians, but to give him his due here, you know, this is a very, very important thing and has influenced modern psychology to a ridiculous degree. William James, who was an American philosopher, historian, and psychologist, was one of the first to describe the mind as a stream of consciousness. And this actually leads to quite a good characterization that I heard from Sam Harris. I know he has terminal Trump derangement syndrome, but on matters of psychology, I actually think he's very good. And he says that consciousness, we like to think of ourselves as being a person on the banks of a stream and watching it go past, but actually we are the stream We can't separate ourselves from the stream itself. That is what we are. We can't just sit on the banks and look at it because it's an intrinsic part of who we are, both consciousness and the unconscious. So it's almost like the unconscious mind is upstream of consciousness in that sort of scenario, that characterization, if that makes sense.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.